I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.
Hi, I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Welcome to Action Packed. On our weekly travel podcast, we interview some amazing people who've ventured to the far corners of the world.
We hope you'll feel as inspired as we do by their extraordinary journeys.
So let's go straight to the action. This week, we're talking to someone who is the very essence of Action Packed. Over the past three decades, you've seen him countless times on TV and on the big screen, crashing cars at high speed and jumping from seven-story buildings when not in the thick of a swashbuckling sword fight. You can be forgiven for not knowing his name, but the formidable Glenn Marks is one of Britain's leading movie stunt coordinators. He's done the dangerous work for some of the biggest names in the business. Glenn, welcome on our travel podcast. So when did this all start for you?
This started when, after I left school, I went to drama school. And I was very lucky. I got in a tour with Sir Anthony Quayle's company, Compass, doing King Lear. We're doing Shakespeare around the UK, including Northern Ireland. And I wrote to a few agents to try and get an agent because I didn't have one. I got that off my own back. And I kept buying theatre tickets when we're in the West End for these agents to turn up. The next day, you have to buy the tickets yourself. So I was spending a fortune on tickets. And then you go the next day, say, with these tickets, and they go, no, here they are, but you don't get any money back. And then you'd speak to the agent's secretary, so no, they're coming tonight. So then you couldn't stick them up in the gods, so you'd have to buy some nice tickets. And by the end of the run in the West End a few months, I was on my own, and that was it. Phone wasn't ringing, and I thought, well, if I end up in I'm not going to end up in another show in the West End with actors that big in it. And I was, I think, about 19, 20 years old. I haven't got an agent. I'm not going to get very far. I like the business, so maybe I'll do something else. And I got a couple of little telly jobs, and they actually got somebody in to double me one day, and he looked nothing like me, riding a horse bareback, and I've plenty of horses at home. So I said, well, he's rubbish. I'll get on and do it. And it's not like today with health and safety. So I jumped on this horse bareback, galloped around a few fields, and jumped off in the end, and they went, oh, all right, you can do that. Got chatting to this stunt guy, and there were virtually no young stunt guys on the stunt register. So I looked into it and I joined and never looked back. 32 years later, I'm still doing it. So that's how I got onto the stunt register and why I joined. And then, here, I suppose there must be something in it that's still appealing, or else I wouldn't be doing it three decades later.
So when you started, did you have to do any sort of training on the job?
Yeah, it's very different now. But the principles are the same. So anybody who wants to join, I'd say the easiest way to find out, you go online and you Google the British Stunt Register, and it says how to join. And in a brief nutshell, you need your equity card. So you have to join the Actors Union. You need to do some live shows. And then you need, I think it's still 6 qualifications from amateur sports to instructor standard. But they're quite varied. So you can't have more than 2 qualifications in one category. So say boxing, martial arts is your thing, and you've got 100 black belts, it doesn't matter. You've still got to go and do 4 other qualifications to instructor standard to get there. So that could be scuba diving, it could be mountain climbing, it could be gymnastics, whatever it is. When people are training to get on the stunt register, I say to them, trampolining and gymnastics are pretty much a must. You have to have a fighting, but I'd say do fencing as well. Scuba diving, although it's expensive, is a good one to do because when you're 30 meters down, you clear your mask in cold water and all this sort of thing. It prepares you quite well for being on the stunt register. If you think getting on and then you're going to just be a glorified supporting artist running around firing a gun, you can forget it because you're going to be doing a lot more than that. So you need to go into it with your eyes open. I say to people, it's pretty much like doing a university degree. It's going to take you at least 3 to 5 years, and it'll cost you the same as doing a university degree. And there's no guarantee of getting a single day's work when you join. Back in the late 80s, when I joined, I was the only one who joined the register for 18 months. Each quarter now, I think they limit it to 50 or 60 applicants, and they've got hundreds waiting to get on. And there was only about 150 people, 200 on the stunt register. Now we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. and anywhere up over 200 a year joining. And I don't know where all the work's going to come from for them, so I wish them luck. Once you're on the stunt register, there's 5 levels to go through to become a coordinator. So nobody's going to ring you up and go, here's your next James Bond film and you're in charge, mate, on day one. So you have to pay your dues. And it's not paying your dues to a coordinator like me, it's paying your dues to the industry to learn and then to teach stunt performers what to do. Because I imagine that everybody virtually coming on my film set has never done it before, because I like them to do it my way. Because touch wood, over 32 years, no accidents, claims or convictions. So in a way, I must be doing something right. So I figure if I came from the acting side, and I'm no Olympic athlete at all, but I can get through what I've done in 32 years, I must be on the right line and the right course. Because what you don't want, and it happens every year, somebody dies or somebody in a wheelchair or loses limbs or something. And, you know, I wouldn't want to live with myself if that was the trail of devastation I left behind me. Because everybody who comes to work, doesn't matter if they're stunt people, actors, crew, sporting artists, whoever they are, they've all got families and friends, and you know, they're doing their job. So you can't be hurting them or putting them in a position where, one, they don't know what they're doing, or two, they can hurt themselves. So that's my job, to get a script, break it down, say what the stunts are. If I put my foot down and I say an actor's not doing this, there's a very good reason why. And that's really because actors do acting and stuntmen do stunts. And I'll make it look like it's the actor doing it, but generally I don't let them do anything dangerous. They've got to make sure they're there at the end of the film in the same physical and mental condition as when they started. I've been coordinating for 27 years now. There we go.
You still do some stunts yourself, do you?
Yeah, because I still love it. So if I read a script and there's a really meaty something, I think I'll do that one. Or I might go, no, I won't do it. But generally, when you coordinate, you end up doing most of the stunts anyway, because you're either teaching the stunt people to do it or in rehearsals, or you're teaching the actors what you want them to do.
So you go to wherever the location is, and that can be anywhere in the world, can it?
Yes, and I've travelled a bit too much over the last 10 years. Well, with Netflix, Amazon, Sky, with these massive budgets, they are pushing the boundaries more and more. So we travel far afield. And last year, to give you an example, I was in Greece, Prague, Germany, France, Spain, India, Morocco. I can't even remember where else. I just kept getting on aeroplanes and going away. And then I did turn down some time in Eastern Europe, about 6 months on one job. I turned another one down somewhere else because I just started something. Kuala Lumpur and Shanghai and wherever else. You know, they really do push it today.
Truth be told, you're happiest in Wiltshire, aren't you?
Well, that's where home is. But there's very little filming on my doorstep. So it doesn't matter where you live today, you're going to be traveling. So I rack up anywhere between 25 and 50,000 miles in the car. I think my record in a year is about 80 or 90 different flights. And I don't know how many train journeys. It depends if you want to go into film or TV. And they're very similar in respects, but very different. So stunt performers, if they start getting employed by the coordinators who do the big movies, they go, yeah, great, I'm on the movies. After about 10 or 15 years of being away from home and hardly ever seeing family and loved ones, they go, well, I wish I did TV and I got home a bit. The guys who are doing TV go, I wish I was doing films and I was on Batman and the Bond film. So the grass is always greener. It depends when you get on, who employs you and which route your career takes or which route you wish your career to take.
So one of your earliest films was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves?
Yeah, and then I did the Ridley Scott Robin Hood, and I hope before I retire I'll do another Robin Hood as well.
And where did you film those? Where did you film those?
Burnham Beaches for Robin Hood's camp. We were at Shepperton Studios for Nottingham Castle for the interior, and then we were down on the beaches somewhere, I think, unless I'm getting the two muddled up, all over the place.
What kind of stunts did you have to do for that, for example?
Riding horses, loads of fighting, loads of bows and arrows. And I'll give you one little example that does make me tickle and how health and safety has changed. I'm quite a good archer. It's something I've just done, and I love firing arrows, and I have targets and bows and arrows at home. So I was up with a chap called Gabe Cronolly, the stunt guy, who's an excellent archer. I'd say to him, from 250 yards, Gabe, if I put this target up, someone was stood there, where would it be? And he comes from Southern Ireland. He went, oh, Jesus, God. He says, you're 250 yards away every time I'd put the arrow in your mouth. That's all I need, something that big. I don't need the whole target. Just put a big orange there and I'll hit it. So we were up on these gangways and we were given the fire arrows. So arrows with some wadding on it, and you've got a bit of fire and it's got fuel on it, petrol or whatever they use, IPA. And you dip it in, you pull your bow back and you're aiming. They wanted us to shoot the fire arrows into these straw huts. So we fired off about five or six each, and there are lots more arrows there. And the director goes, keep firing. And I went, no, I'm not firing anymore. He said, you're a bloody stunt man, fire those arrows. I said, no, because the arrows aren't true. If you fire an arrow that isn't true, it'll go off one way or go off the other, and there's no saying where it'll go. And you've got camera crew. He was throwing so much. I went, all right, then I'll fire one. But if I kill someone, mate, it's on you. So I fired this arrow, and it went sort of 90 degrees and landed behind the crew. And the first assistant director shouted, what do you think that? I said, haven't got any more straight arrows. I'm not firing anymore because I'll kill somebody. We went, right, cut the cameras. The director was going mad. I said, there are a few of us who are really good archers, and I'll put that arrow wherever you want, as long as it's true. As long as it's a straight arrow. If you give me something bent as a five bob, no, good luck to you. We did loads on it. And in the final edit, there's a little sequence where I end up killing myself. So what will happen is you're on Robin Hood's gang one side in your green tights and whatever, and you're fighting. And this particular time I was firing a bow and arrow. Then they cut to when I was a Celt on a horse and I got the arrow in my chest because of makeup and costume. And it's all so quick, people don't notice. But quite often when we see the edit back, like Wonder Woman recently, I shot myself on that. I was a German firing, and then I was the English guy who died, you know. You think with these massive budgets, surely they could get more people in, but it's just the way it gets edited. And yeah, it's quite nice to kill myself.
Other ones in the UK, Poldark. Did you film
that? Well, I had a lovely time on Poldark. That was months in and not far from me. That was one that was at times nearly on my doorstep. We have so many stately homes around here in Wiltshire. They were based in Bristol, which is an hour from me. And I loved it. And then we would go down to Cornwall. Between Cornwall and wherever, it was months and months of work, and I loved it. It was just great fun. Loads of stunts on it, loads to do. But you're not just doing that one show. So Poldark would last for me for 6 or 7 months because you got the prep beforehand and everything else. But while you're doing that, and I call them my regulars, I'm very lucky that a director or producer I worked before goes, oh, we want you to do this show. I say, well, I can't turn them down because otherwise they go to somebody else and they don't use you again. So while I was doing Poldark, I was doing Pennyworth. I was doing Coronation Street. I was doing about six other jobs. And then you try and fit them all in one to the other. And that's fine when they've set their schedules, but you get one schedule on one production because an actor is ill or the weather changes and they lose a location or whatever. And suddenly you find you've got to be on five film sets in a day. And obviously that doesn't work. So, but it's one of my fond memories of filming, I'd say, is Poldark. There's a few of them, but Poldark was fun.
So did you have to be Aidan Turner?
No, actually, as it happened, I didn't get a double in for Aidan at all. One, the stunts didn't demand it, if it's fighting and things like that. Also, we did a lot of sword fighting on it. If you've seen the show, you'll see it. But Aidan came from a dancing background, and he'll pick up a routine in absolutely no time. So I can come up with a routine and then variants within that. So what I do, I don't mind telling some of my secrets. If there's a sword fight, there's no point if it's going to last 4 minutes trying to teach him 4 minutes because nobody will get there in their head. So what I do is I number them. So I go, right, to get to this point where you've got some dialogue, that's sequence one. So I'll teach him sequence one. I'll go through it two or three times and he knows it. And I had Vincent Regan on the other side, and Vincent is really good with a saber. So I got lucky. And then I go, right, number two is this bit. And then when we actually came to shoot one of the sword fights, it was the last day and they were running out of time. And I said, well, look, if we go straight from three, miss out four and go to five, and you add a line in here. Oh, yeah, I know where we're going. Camera here and on we go. If you the whole sword fight was one bit. If I go, right, well, after you get to, oh, well, that bit, if we miss that bit out and that it just it doesn't work. And however much time and money the show have got, you never have enough time and money when you're doing stunts generally. You always want another day, another week, more money, more people, more time. But you don't have that luxury. So you have to cut your cloth and you have to take a step back. And over much you're in love with a fight scene or something you're doing, you've got to be prepared to chop it in half. And then sometimes, not on Pulled Up, but sometimes we can sit with the editor and go, look, if you take that sequence and push that into that bit and double that up and then turn around and do that, that'll look like another bit of the sequence, but we're just replaying something. And quite often we'll catch the audience out. They won't notice. And we ended up actually doing some of that on Pulled Up. But I have to say, Aidan was a pleasure and just lovely. And when you get an actor, him and Vincent together, and then they put their character on what you give them, it just brings the thing alive and it's great fun.
So you've obviously got your favourite actors and your actors you don't like working with.
Well, you normally find that the bigger the stars are, the nicer they are. They also understand that I've got a job to do. My job is to make them look good. So for any actor to fall out with a stunt coordinator would have to be pretty amateurish, really, because you've got to look at the bigger picture on why we're there. I very rarely do interviews, certainly not on TV. I don't talk on radio. I don't have Facebook and all these things and promote what I do because I'm very lucky and the phone rings and I go to work. So generally, actors give us a really easy time and the clever ones use us like a sponge and soak up everything they can off us. You know, we spend our whole career just doing the action scenes and there's very little you can throw at me now in a script that in some variant or other I haven't done. And you'll always try and make it fresh and you don't want to bring the same fights back at all. But, you know, as far as actual stunts go, if I hadn't have covered it all in 32 years, then it would be a bit of a worry, really. Actors I don't like. Really, so I mean, there was one who I think he was sort of up and coming and tried to get a little bit too big for his boots. So he walked when we start with this big production meeting, as I said on Pulled Up, they run around the table. There are no actors there, the actors are nowhere to be seen. And he stormed in at the beginning of this, halfway through this production meeting. He went, "Oi, you, I'm the lead actor, you're just a stunt, and you do what I say, what I say," and you are, and just started swearing at me. And I thought, well, you know, it's a long film. I'll get my own back. And the director and producer sort of walked him out of the room, didn't want to fight there. So about 2 weeks into it, the location manager came to me and he said, "Glenn, look, the director has found another location to do this car where you're going to spin a car around." He goes, "But I don't think the car will actually fit." I said, "Look, I can't leave set at the moment. How far is it?" He goes, "It's Highgate. We're filming London. It's 20 minutes up the road." I said, "Great. At 1 o'clock when we break for lunch, just be in your car ready, take me there. Well, it's 20 minutes there, 20 minutes back. Well, I'll be there about 10, 15 minutes. He said, "Well, you won't get any lunch." I went, "Well, I don't mind if I miss a meal. I'll get the caterers to do something." Yeah, so we drove up to Highgate and I thought the same. I thought this car will not that I can't spin it, but I can't spin it without smashing it up. Because you've got a 10-foot brick wall one side. How's the other side? So I measured it. Went back, measured this car, and actually, if you measure the perpendicular, don't go front to back because it's wider on the spin when it's coming round, so you've got to go from corner to corner. It would fit with about 5 inches either side. So I took some cones from the location department. I said to the car suppliers, I said, "You drive my car home, I'm taking this car," and they didn't like it, but they didn't have a choice. And I went to my local Tesco car park, and I chalked up where the road is, and I put the cones down. Did it the first time. I wiped the cones out on the right-hand side. So I went a bit further left, and then I wiped the cones out on the left side. So I put it in between, put a little chalk mark down, went down, didn't hit any cones. And I thought, right, that's as wide as the street. So I have a rule. If I can do a stunt in a car 3 times perfectly, and I mean perfectly, in a car park, then I should be able to do it on the location. So I measured out from the wall where the middle of the wheel was to start with, put a chalk mark. I measured out from the car park how many meters I needed and how far from each wall, and did a little stone, a little chalk mark where the middle of the front, left-hand front wheel was so I could spin the car around. And I'm sitting there at about 2 a.m. going, "All right, I've got to be back on set soon. I'm going to give this a go. If I smash it up, I'll smash it up. I'm going to smash it up on the day anyway. If I don't get it right, so might as well do it." So I went out, went round, perfect. It fitted. So I made my little chalk mark a bit bigger. The next day we get there and I'm just dressed in normal clothes and the director of photography is, so Glenn, I said, well, look, just as a guess, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll just put the car where it is. And I wandered down this tiny little narrow street and I went, I'll just put a chalk mark here. And I covered over my previous chalk mark. I said, I think the middle of the left-hand front wheel will be there. But anyway, I said, line the camera up and then focus can do distances because the little focus chap's got to go there and focus as I'm doing it and get it right. So everything's, you know, in vision, not blurred. I said, I'll just give it a go. So went down, span the car around. They all come running over. Sure enough, the wheel's in the middle of the chalk mark's in the middle of the wheel. How'd you know it'd be that? I said, oh, just a guess. I said, right, we'll go back to camera. I called this lead actor over and I went, you told me you do all your own stunts, mate. Off you go then. Bye. And I walked back to the camera and I was listening out for him to think, if he gets in that car and I hear the door shut, I'll have to go and stop him because he will smash up the car, because I had to rehearse doing it. If I'd done it first time, I'd have smashed up the car and he can't drive and I know I can drive. So I'm standing there, I turn around and I can see him swallow. And I thought, right, I've got you now. And the producer, production manager kind of said, Glenn, what are you doing? You can't. I said, no, that's for calling me James Blunt when we're in the production meeting. So that'll stop him. It's rhyming slam for James Blunt. Oh, I actually really like, but I think it's brilliant in your life. You can always be remembered as the rudest word in the English dictionary through rhyming slam. But there you go. I love his songs. And he called me over. I went, no, it's Eli. I just did it. I just made it up. I just guessed for it. I go, and it's easy. He's got friends, family there all showing off and everything. On the third time, I went over and I went, who feels the now? And I said, when are you going to get it into your thick head that I'm here to make you look good? I'm not here to take away your glory. I said, and you've been battling me for the last 2 weeks. And what you did in the production meeting, I said, you know, I'm just here to do a job that I love. Work with me and I'll make you look really good. I said, now you've got back behind the camera, because we both know you can't do this. I said, if you really want to know, I rehearsed this last night and the chalk mark was already on the ground. I said, I don't leave things to chance. Now the crew will think I've just turned up and done it, but I'm not that stupid. We've only got one car. I'm not going to write it off. Now after that, it was really nice and we got on fine. But that's about the only time I've had to pull an actor up because he's just being, you know. But generally, no, they're really pleased to have the job. They've been paid a fortune. We're there to do the fun bits. So I tend not. Yes, you do have your favourites. I mean, there's no question. There's some that are just lovely. I mean, Jennifer Aniston, as far as leading ladies go, is just brilliant. I did Derailed with her. It was a $100 million movie. And, you know, we were just best mates. But now she doesn't write. She doesn't call. I don't get any emails. Never hear from her again.
And I know you said Eddie Redmayne was great to work with.
He was lovely, but what a talented man. This was a theory of everything with Eddie Redmayne, the life of Stephen Hawking. And one of the locations, apart from having lots of lovely weeks in Cambridge, we're at Harrow School. There's a scene where there's a big statue of Queen Victoria, and I was there that night. And Eddie was in the wheelchair and in the costume playing Stephen Hawking. And I walked up to him, there's no one around. I went, Eddie, he went, yeah, Glenn. And I went, I'm just speechless at how physical you are, because you are Stephen Hawking. It is just mind-bogglingly, it's just a privilege to be on this film set and watch you work, because you are so talented. He said, well, you've had to learn the walk and everything else, because I doubled him at one bit, doing some bits, when he did the fall, when he fell over and stuff, although we only used the stuff on Eddie in the end. And we had a movement coach, an American lady, and forgive me, I can't remember her name, but she was brilliant. And she would spend hours with Eddie and hours with myself and some of the stunties and teaching us and how to hold our shoulder and how to walk and our feet and our head and where our hands were. And it was just a brilliant, brilliant experience. And I really enjoyed it because the beginning of the film, I shot all that, the bicycle bit at the beginning. You might go, oh, there are no stunts in that. But we were limited in time when we got to Cambridge, and I had a couple of doubles, and then I had the actors for a bit. And James Marsh was directing, said, oh, well, look, can you shoot the beginning for me? Quite often, as stunt coordinator, you'll go in second unit direct. So you're given a unit, and you go, I said, look, you know how to make it fun and thing. And then he turned up in the afternoon when we were going through the gates and doing the bit, and there it was, the beginning of the movie. And I went, oh, I shot that. I found those locations. That's really cool. I really enjoyed that. So I love it when I'm given my own film unit and I go off in second unit direct. And we were in, maybe it was Jesus College. So when you go into the entrance, those haven't been to Cambridge, they have chaps in waistcoats or tails, very smart, who you can't just walk into the college because they're there at the reception then when you go inside. So I'm waiting with the location manager to look at some location, and the porters are there. It was a nice warm day, and it was obviously a dad and his daughter came in, and the daughter was probably about to do her A-levels. And she was obviously got herself so worried, poor little thing. She went up to these porter chaps and said, "I'm a suspected prudent. Can I have a look around, please?" And I said, "I think you mean you're a prospective student, but you're not here to study English, are you?" She went, "No." I said, "Perfect, then. You'll be all right, then." Isn't that lovely? I'm a suspected prudent. I love tongue twisters. I get it quite a lot on film texts that sometimes people open their mouths and say things before their brain is engaged. And it gives given me many, many little stories of huge laughter and mirth. So I'll give you an example. I was doing one film, and my job was to run at this glass. It was a skyscraper in the city of London, so one of these glass skyscrapers. It was only about a seventh floor. It wasn't too high. And then you run through the glass, and then you fall and land in an airbag. And what you do for that, you hear about this sugar glass, but you can't make it that big. So it's toughened glass, and the special effects put debts, so they put charges on the glass. And then it's up to the special effects guys to press the button just as before you run through it. And if they don't, you're going to splat yourself into the glass because you're at full pelt. And if they do it too early, you can't use the shot because the glass is broken and I haven't got there. So you have to put out your mind as a performer that this toughened glass is there in front of you. So in my mind, the toughened glass isn't there, and it's just you have to trust your special effects guy that he's going to press the button. When we look back, he pressed it 7 frames before I hit it. So if you're filming at 24, 25 frames a second, that's a blink of an eye. So that's pretty good when you're on the sprint. So if you're sprinting, you then can't accelerate. You have to keep at a constant speed. So anyway, I went through the glass, landed. The glass always gets there before you because you take some with you. Got off the airbag, no cuts, bruises, fine. And the director came up to me all excited. And he said, "That was great, great. Now, you know you're going to jump again." I said, "Yes, that's right. They'll put the window in. Take about an hour. Great. Now, when you go next time, I want you to fall slower." I said, "When I'm falling through the air, you want me to decelerate to fall slower, do you?" He said, "Yes, yes. And then I'll get the shot I want." I said, "Right." He said, "What do you think of that?" I said, "Well, look, I'm a stuntman." I said, "I'll fall any speed you like. You know, that was normal speed. I can fall quicker. Or if I take a big deep breath of air, you know, I'm sure I'll fall a bit slower." "Great. Great, we'll do that." I said, "But before you go, Mr. Director," I said, "I don't think you've quite thought this through, have you?" He said, "Yes, I have." I went, "No, come here. No, you haven't." I said, "When you play it back, and obviously being a stuntman, I'll fall slower, you haven't accounted for the speed of the glass. So imagine the glass is falling at normal speed because of gravity and I'm going slow. So when you play it back, it's going to look..." "Oh," he said, "I didn't think of that." I said, no, I don't." I said, "Look, back in the year 1642, this very clever fellow was born. And nobody knows exactly when, but some years later, he was sat under a tree and an apple fell on his head." He went, "Yeah." I said, "Well, his name was Sir Isaac Newton, and he came up with the theory of gravity. And here in the city of London at 2:30 in the morning, I'm not going to try and defy Newton's laws on physics because I'm nowhere near that clever. Right? Just not in 1,000 of my lifetimes could I be as clever as Newton was in those few seconds or any of his lifetime. I'm just not in that league. I'm just a stuntman. So I'll do the same, and we'll have a little chat with our lovely director of photography, and maybe he'll turn the cameras over crank it maybe 100 frames a second. Then when you play it back, it'll be 4 times slower. The glass will be slower. I'll be slower, and you'll get what you want." "Great. Right, right." Then to my astonishment, he had no idea what I was talking about. He stopped the entire crew, barriers, people watching, everything, probably about 185 crew or something. "Right, everybody stop. Right, what we're going to do now is we're going to move the cameras. And what are we going to do with the cameras again? Is he going to overcrank? Right, we're going to overcrank 100 frame, but the stuntman here, he won't fall slower." And all the crew are looking at me like, "Man," I just went, "Wasn't me, mate. That's your director for you." Isn't that great? Fall slower. I mean, during car chases, I've had directors ask me to drive faster without going quicker. I mean, you try doing that. If you're doing 80, you're doing 80, aren't you? You can't then say you're doing 100. Just drive faster and don't go any quicker. So there you go. Little things like that keep me amused on the film. Okay?
So where do you reckon is the most exotic location you've ever filmed? Would that be for Star Wars?
Perhaps? No, because Star Wars actually is pretty boring. Most of the time we're at Pinewood Studios, or the most exotic probably was, I filmed quite a bit in the Caribbean, as it happens. For the little drummer girl, the John Le Carré, we were over a month in Greece at this magnificent resort, the second most expensive resort in Greece. I mean, the crew were upset because the beers at the bar were sort of 20 euros for a little bottle of beer, but we had our own private beach. I had this huge suite with a balcony overlooking the beach and then Poseidon's temple in the distance. I mean, it was just magnificent. Some of the chateaus in France we've stayed at. I know too many to count, really. I mean, just beautiful places we've been. The private estates, stately homes I've been into in the private parts that only the family or close friends would go to that aren't open to the general public, or a treat.
Now, you once told me you specialise in setting yourself on fire. You've done quite a bit of that, haven't you?
It wasn't through choice, trust me. It wasn't through choice. So what happened, when I first got on the stunt register, London's Burning, so the older people of my generation remember it, you youngsters won't even know what we're talking about, but basically it was a TV series about the fire brigade, and Paul Knight was the producer on it, and they had a huge budget. So to give you an idea, I think the budget was about £860,000 an episode. I might be wrong, and that's back then. At the same time, the Bill was shooting an episode for £115,000. So it was a big budget. And obviously being fire, and in that time it was deemed more acceptable to see lots of people on fire, it ended up we were being set on fire time and time. And I don't mean just an arm or your leg. I mean full body burns with the flames 4 or 5 foot above your head. And I seemed to get my unfair share of fire jobs. And I used to think it was because everyone hated me, until I twigged one day it's actually what's in the script. And maybe because I've done it so often now, people keep ringing me to do them. And I still end up being set on fire. I've done 197 full burns now, and I always said I'd stop at 200, so I've got 3 to go, but I might do 201 just to spite myself. and then let the youngsters do it.
Are these usually in a studio or out on?
No, location. Britannia last year was night shoots at location. I've been asked to do a couple more on Britannia coming up. Can't tell you the sequence, we're not allowed to. The last one I did actually was inside, and then you have to be careful because it wasn't just me being on fire, I got hit by a fireball. So you need somewhere for that fire to escape. So it's more than just being set on fire. There's always, anybody can stand there and be set on fire to a degree. It's just every fire job is different because normally you're given 100 other things to do while you're on fire. So, you know, it just depends what the sequence is.
Had it ever gone wrong in your 197?
I have got burnt twice, but you learn pretty quick not to do it again. But I would say on the whole, no, I'm very formulaic when I do it. I have my, if you asked me to tell you what the formula is now, I'd have to rack my brains to try and write it down. But when I'm on a set and I've got all my equipment and I've got everything I need, no, I just go into my little zone. Normally, at that point, I'll include the first assistant director, but he and the director are pretty much irrelevant to me. I have to ignore them. And I'll give them one way of doing it that we've decided and agreed on before, so don't think I'm being a dictator on this. But we don't work in a democracy on a film set. And when I'm doing something like a fire job or something that's that dangerous, I really don't want to hear anybody else's voice. It's down to me. After I finish that, I'll give the set back to them and thank you very much. But if you can't live with me doing it and hearing my voice and nobody interfering, then don't have me on your film set. Because as I say, I've done hundreds and hundreds of these, and I won't have somebody tell me, oh, you shouldn't be doing that or you should be doing this.
You spent quite a lot of time jumping off buildings.
Yeah, high falls. My highest, you can Google it, is the Harbour Exchange, the Isle of Dogs. I went off the roof. That's 17 stories. 2 weeks before that was a harder one, although it was only 16 stories, and that was St George's Heights in Liverpool. And it was harder because I had to have my hands handcuffed behind my back and I was only wearing boxer shorts and a T-shirt and it was pouring with rain. The other thing that made it hard on that particular one was the canopy at the front for the entrance to the building was 12 foot high and went out 16 feet, and the edge of it was right where I knew I would land. So obviously you can't land on concrete or have it in the way. So I had to build my rig big enough that and tall enough to almost forget about this concrete canopy so that I knew I'd be safe. And when I was up there, I was sitting on the edge and I put my foot over the rig that I'd put to land on. It disappeared under my right foot. And I went, maybe I haven't built this big enough quite. That is rather small. And I put a huge, great big white, I suppose a meter by a meter plus sign on it. And the director of photography said, so where are you going to land? I said, no, my chest will be in the middle of that plus sign, middle of that cross. And he went, yeah, but how many feet either way? I went, no, none. I said, I'll be there. Otherwise, you might as well just scoop me up with a shovel and put what's left in a box. So the trick with those is that you mustn't push, because you will travel way too. Anyone who's done trampolining or gymnastics knows you spot where you're going to land and you don't have anything else in your head other than that's where you're going to land. And you can't muck about from that sort of height because you won't be here anymore.
Well, how do you break the fall on something of 16 stories high?
It depends. There are different ways of doing it. So I wouldn't give a definitive on it, and I don't really want to say because I don't want people to go out and try it. Now with CGI and wires and things, I mean, I've done a lot higher, but on a wire, but then you're on a descender. So it's a very simple process of physics. The descender is basically a reel of aluminium, and it gets smaller. So if you think, if you wind a wire around the thicker part, you're going to get a lot more cable than you will around the smaller part. So you make sure that you start the reel of cable, if you like, on the left-hand side where it's thicker. And then as this descender's built, it gets smaller to the right-hand side and you have less cable. So you'll then decelerate because it uses less cable as you come near the end. It's then got pretty much a motorbike handle with brakes on it. So your wire man, your brake man, who's going to slow you down and stop you crashing into rocks, water, whatever. So say you're doing a drop of 400 feet. You can't hit water at terminal velocity from 400 feet because you'll die. It's as simple as that. So he's then on the brakes. And what you've got to make sure is that you trust your wire man, because obviously if he brakes too hard, there's too much snatch, the cable will break. So there's no point actually being on a cable. And if he goes too late, again, if he goes too early, you've then got to do the stunt again. So you can rehearse with a weighted dummy and this, but you really need to trust your wire man. And I only use one wire man, and he's absolutely brilliant, and he's worked for me for forever. And I think pretty much when we're the same age, when he retires, I'll have to retire because I don't see how I could do jobs without him. So that's one way of wires. Otherwise, you build a landing rig to go in, and you better build them properly because otherwise you'll go straight through it. Dar Robinson did the highest fall out of a helicopter 210 feet into an airbag that NASA developed. And a French guy tried, can't remember his name, a French stuntman tried 2 weeks later, and he went straight through the airbag and died. He went a bit higher. And that airbag would have cost, I don't know how much to make and develop, and no production company is going to pay for it. So I have a limit that I will let stunt people jump from before I cheat it. Because I know the limits because I've been there myself. So if they say, oh, it's only 200 feet, can jump from that, I'm like, not going to happen, guys. You do it on a wire, or we'll do it against green screen, or we'll do this, or we'll do that. The different ways of doing it. So I do put limits on things. We're not mad people who'll just have a go at anything. You've got to be calculated in what you do and know that whoever you're putting there can walk away from it.
So what's been your most dangerous experience?
Well, normally, the biggest stunts you've had most time to prepare for. So they actually become your safest stunts. I would say they're jobs where they're done on the fly. So you'd be in the middle of a production and they go, oh, we just want to and go and do that. And you haven't got the right equipment there. It was a film I wasn't coordinating. Somebody else was, but I happened to be up there. And we were up in Whitby and they had the tall ships out. And for some reason, the producer decided he wanted a shot of a couple of sailors. It was a period thing at the top of one of the masts in the crow's nest, climbing out of a barrel, basically. And I spoke to the line producer and said, look, this is 120 feet up. He said, oh, don't worry about that. It's only going to be in the harbour. There's no current. I said, it's still 120 feet up. And I've got no harnesses, no ropes, no anything. I said, look, I don't have a fear of heights and I'll do it and I'll climb up and down. I said, but if this boat leaves the harbour, I said, I won't be in the crow's nest. No, it's all shot in the harbour. So they filmed it from the side. Next thing I know, they're pushing the boat off. And I thought, Now, this is never going out to sea because the North Sea that day was really rough. And there was another camera boat following us. And I had a radio, and I said to the first one, I said, well, what are you doing, guys? There's no remit for this. Well, turn the boat round and go back. No, 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 the producer wants to shoot the same thing out to sea. I went, right, I'm climbing out. Unfortunately, this all took a bit of time, and my trying to climb out coincided with leaving the safety of the harbour. So now, because it's so rough, the boat is pitching from left to right, probably about 80 feet, maybe 100 feet, and it's going up and down with the swell that you couldn't climb out the thing. It was just impossible. The other stunt guy with me, well, he went green, and you know, we saw the contents of his stomach over the last couple of days in this barrel. It was revolting. I'm lucky I don't suffer from seasickness. And just at the worst bit, the director goes, okay, roll call, action, climb out the thing. And the boat's over at sort of 45 degrees and all the crew are hanging on below. And I'm like, well, what do you think it's like for us, 120 feet up? So I said to the first, you can tell that director what he can do with his call for action. If he doesn't like it, he can come up here and do it. I said, I'll try and give him one when we're almost upright. So I went to climb out. I had a foot out and the boat, it just caught the worst possible moment. And I ended up, and I'm quite strong for my body weight. And I was hanging on with two fingers and I could see the sea below me. And I thought, well, shall I drop now? But then I thought, if I drop into the sea from 120 feet, one, is anybody going to come and get me? If the boat swells back, I'm on the deck and they might as well just get a shovel and a little bag or shove me overboard to feed the seagulls because there won't be anything left. But I actually don't know if I'm going to be able to hold on again when we tilt to the right to be able to get back onto the rigging again, because you're flying out sideways on this thing. Fortunately, as it hit me, I managed to get my legs through the rigging, my arms through it. And the other guy, he was still at the bottom of the barrel. He went, no, I can't use that. I need both of you. I said, pass me up that radio. So I told the director what I thought of him. And I couldn't get back in the physically with the Jeep, I could not get back in the barrel. And I said to the first, two things are going to happen. I said, one is you're going to turn the boat round now and you're going to go back into the harbour and you're going to shoot it again in the harbour. I said, I don't care that you and the director are on another boat. I said, otherwise I will get on that boat and I will put this director and you up here and you'll see why it cannot be done. So we went back to the harbour. The line producer, Ronaldo, dear friend of mine, he was mortified. He was having to go at the producer. He wouldn't let me anywhere near him because I'd have knocked his head off. At the end of the day, why did that happen? You don't let... You know, for me, I have a golden rule. If you give the producer a camera, they will try and get sometimes, and I can't say this about everybody, but this particular producer was pushing it and thought something in his head thought it had to be done out at sea in this ridiculous swell. So it's things that are done on the hoof that can be really dangerous. And you have to have the gumption to go, no, I'm not doing this. That is too dangerous. The stunt coordinator was nowhere to be seen. I think he was thrown up somewhere and just, you know, things like that. Animals can be tricky. I've been bitten to pieces by a couple of Alsatians. Data, this dog got me big time once, bit me, blood spurted up in the air, bit right through my ankle. Another one was going for my face. I managed to get my left arm up and he bit through my left wrist. And I punched the hell out of the dogs. And I love dogs, had my own, but these ones would have ripped my face off if I hadn't. And they're supposed to be trained for film sets. There you go. And the producer was like, oh my God, oh my God. I said, well, I'll go off to hospital now and have some stitches. And I'll come back, but those dogs are off the set. And I think half the crew had disappeared by then anyway. So they're probably about the worst two. Can't think of much else.
Any other animals? I mean, sort of like lions or elephants?
Oh, black panthers, tarantulas, snakes, you name it, all over the place. Yes, loads of them all the time. You can't be squeamish about that sort of thing. If you don't like tarantulas and snakes, then get another job, because you as a stuntman, you know you're going to be the mug in there doing it. Alligators, crocodiles, doesn't matter. It was all the same.
So Doctor Who is one that you've done, isn't it?
Yeah, I love working on Doctor Who. I did at the time when David Tennant was there. I recently did the, it's not out yet, Dennis Nielsen. He was a serial killer. And we did a TV series about him, David Tennant playing him. Before that, I was on David's last TV series. When he did just before that. We got on great. I've known him for many, many years. And I don't really mind what the show is called or who it is. It's mainly now about working with people I like and, you know, just not taking on too many shows at the same time that you can't work on them. Well, at the moment with coronavirus, it's all been quiet for a bit. But then I start up again next week.
And you're the first stuntman going back to work next week.
First coordinator, I think, who's back on set. Aren't I lucky on Monday?
And where will that be?
Manchester. Coronation Street, but I'm not allowed to tell you the stunt we're doing. Well, I'm actually doing a few episodes of Coronation Street. So, yeah, so I'll be coming and going quite a bit. So I just take the philosophy that you're lucky to be working. The job comes up, you take it. And there's no point leaving halfway through to do a bigger and better job because you're working anyway. And when you finish, there'll be something else. So you can't stitch people up and leave halfway through a movie to go, oh, well, actually, now I've got the new Batman. So, you know, sod your film. I'm off to do a better one with better pay. You make your bed, you lie in it.
And how have you spent your time during lockdown? Are you restless to get out there and be doing something?
No, I never imagined. I'm very lucky. I'm blessed. I've got lots of lovely children and twins that are quite young. And I never imagined in my working career I would actually have this much time with the kids. In my head, when this started, I always imagined this would go on for some time. And so I thought, enjoy it. The weather's beautiful. We're in a lovely part of Wiltshire. I've got acres and acres of land. I'm very lucky. Well, I decided to move out of London and you get a lot more in Wiltshire than you do in London, as far as land goes. And I decided to enjoy it and homeschool the kids and work on the land. I've lost a stone in weight because of all the gardening and stone shifting I've done. And
Glenn, you used to have a military tank in your garden with a narrow gateway onto the lane beyond. As always during your remarkable career, I think I'm right in saying that it allows no margin at all for error.
Yeah, I've still got the tank. It's in the garden. Well, that one's an Abbott. And it's immaculate. It's all road legal. So I pick the kids up from school in it. We do the village fete, the school fete. And I have rented out on film sets, driven over cars and through buildings, and as you do. Well, I slow down a bit to get through my gates, but I have an inch either side. It is quite wide. So if you imagine, I get called quite a lot to do stunts with big rigs, you know, the Arctics with trailers or buses, because I've got a license for everything. And the first time I turned up with the tank, I was like, I don't think this will fit. And it literally is a cigarette paper either side. But I've got it, as I lived here 11 years now, I know exactly which bit of the road to turn in. So I just whiz her in quite fast and whiz through and haven't taken the gates out yet. Yet, I say. So, yeah, but it's 22 tons, so it's not too heavy. I would like a T-72. I think they're 56 tons, but they are just too wide and too big.
Well, I know that if anyone can find a way to do it, you will. Glenn Marks, thank you so much for coming on our travel podcast and the best of luck with post-viral Coronation Street and your next movie. Stay safe, and we mean it. The phrase has a whole load of extra significance when applied to you and your life.
Thank you very much.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, do please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or another of the many platforms that we're on. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with at least one other person.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.